Creative Babble.
So, Neil, we call this show the Ponzi Playbook. We call them Ponzi schemes. But Ponzi schemes have been happening throughout history for a long time, even before Charles Ponzi, right?
I mean, we're going back millennia, right? Scams, frauds, even classic Ponzi schemes have been going on for thousands and thousands of years. In fact, we have that saying, you know, you're going to rob Peter to pay Paul.
That's right.
That's not something that comes from, you know, last week. Somebody just made that up. That's yeah. That's a biblical reference. So it's got its roots in some real history.
Yeah. And I would imagine ever since the Chinese invented paper that people have been doing Ponzi schemes, right? So tell me about this. Why do we call it Ponzi schemes? Like, why Ponzi? Why did he get the honor of having this title?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Charles Ponzi is sort of, you know, the archetypal Ponzi schemer. And we have to go back 100 years. And he was running his scam as an Italian immigrant. And he was selling international reply coupons. And he was telling people, oh, yeah, I could, you know, kind of flip this and provide you this massive return. He was taking investor money and he was paying those investors with prior investors' money and living the lavish lifestyle, the classic Ponzi schemer. But it wasn't a Ponzi scheme then because Charles Ponzi was the one who was doing it.
He was Agent Zero or whatever.
It was Agent Zero. And here we've gone on, and that's only 100 years ago. And as we already discussed, this goes back thousands of years, scams, frauds, financial frauds.
You kind of mentioned to me before that the word Ponzi scheme is almost could be a little offensive, right?
I think so.
Why is that? Like, I don't see it.
You know, my mother's an Italian American. I grew up in central New Jersey with a lot of Italian American friends. I lived in Italy, studied Italian, taught Italian. It's a part of my past. And we all know that Italian immigrants were looked down upon. 100 years ago, they were thought of as, I mean, sleazy, slimy. And Italian immigrants, they came over practicing a lot of what they knew in order to sort of make ends meet. They came from a tremendous amount of poverty. They didn't have opportunity. When they came and saw Manhattan at Ellis Island, it was like landing on Mars. Like, they had no concept of that. So wealth, money, opportunity. But what they did know is how to wake up in the morning and try to figure out how to put food on the table. I mean, it's the classic immigrant struggle.
Yeah.
So when I hear Ponzi, what I hear is that our culture looked back upon certain qualities that associated with the scheme and picked out the perfect schemer who happened to be an Italian American, who happened to sort of embody a lot of those thoughts, those negative thoughts.
Even though we know that there are many different types of Ponzi schemers, you know, from every country has a Ponzi schemer, as we now know, we're like 14, 15 episodes in, there's a Ponzi scheme for everything.
That's right.
So it's true. It's like very convenient that we picked Charles Ponzi to be our poster boy. But, you know, I think we should probably change that a little bit. Why don't we go back a Ponzi before Ponzi? Like, who was the Charles Ponzi before Charles Ponzi?
Well, I have someone for you, Javier. Do you think I just showed up today without doing a little research?
Oh, you showed up with the goods, man.
I showed up with the goods. And we're going to be talking about today Ferdinand Ward. I mean, come on, this guy, Ferdinand Ward.
Not a household name, right?
Not a household name, but should be a household name. And why don't we redefine it? Ferdinand Ward, you know what he did? He had a Ward scheme. So
not a Ponzi scheme,
it's not a Ponzi scheme. Yeah. It's the Ward playbook.
That's right.
So we're going to be going down the Ward playbook today. So
this, for our listeners, be warned, we are going back. This is our first history episode, historical episode. Right now, we're breaking new ground.
Yes, we're breaking new grounds. We thought we would mix it up a little bit and take us back to the 1800s. We are going back to 19th century America. And this story is riveting. And any victim of a Ponzi scheme, if they are listening, I can promise you that by the end of this episode, you should feel no guilt about being a victim of a Ponzi scheme, because the person we will get to who is a victim of this Ponzi scheme, you'd never imagine could be duped. But that person was. So it's a really fascinating story, Javier.
All right. Well, we won't give it away because the victim, like you said, is pretty striking that this person fell for this.
I'm Neil McTighe.
I'm Javier Leyva.
And this is the Ward Playbook.
Everybody, I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watching on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
So, Neil, do you think that I could ever maybe trick Barack Obama or George W. Bush into investing in this investment scheme that I have? It promises humongous, gigantic, enormous returns. Maybe Donald Trump would be interested in this one. It's huge.
Javier, I was listening to you there and all sorts of red flags were going up. So I was like, oh man, what's this guy selling? You know?
But do you think any of those guys would be dumb enough to fall for my word scheme?
You know, George Santos got elected. So. Yeah. I think Barack Obama could be duped. I think Donald Trump could be duped. I think all of these folks.
I don't think so. I don't think so. Who could dupe a president of the United States or, let's say, a war hero? I mean, come on. Nobody would fall for that. Not those guys.
It seems like that would be the case. But I have proof that it happens.
What?
I have proof.
All right, do tell.
Here's the proof. Ulysses S. Grant went bankrupt because he, Javier, fell for a Ponzi scheme. Oops, I mean, a Ward scheme. He fell for a Ward scheme. So if Ulysses S. Grant could be duped.
I find this so hard to believe.
It is true. This, the great Civil War general who then became the president of the United States, one of the most dignified and honorable men of all American history, was conned by a con man. He gave up all of his dough and he was a pauper and he had only one way out. And that's very interesting how he was able to sort of rebuild his financial life. But yeah, he fell for one of these guys. So Barack Obama, Trump, you name it, Biden, they're all potential victims.
Wow. No one's safe from these Ponzi schemers. So let's talk about it. Because I honestly, until you came up with this episode idea, I had never heard of this. Like, It seems preposterous, but let's get into it. We've been talking about this guy named Ferdinand Ward. He's our Ponzi schemer, which That's we're right. calling a Ward schemer. And he somehow managed to bamboozle the president of the United States. One of the most, you know, like the guy is in our freaking money, all right? Like yes. his picture is on our
You want that money,
currency.
Too.
Yeah. And so if he got duped, I want to know all about this. So go ahead, tell us.
Well, Ferdinand Ward Javier was born back in November of 1851 in upstate New York, Geneseo, New York. And he became known as the young Napoleon of France. Okay. So about the 1860s, right during the Civil War and also into the 1870s, Ferdinand Ward started to plant his roots in the financial world and got involved with some investment firms. He started attracting investors, including prominent figures, not yet Ulysses S. Grant, but he started to build a reputation. And he was always delivering returns. So he was, you know, the young Napoleon of France, right? This guy is just like the big deal. He moves to New York City in 1873, and then he starts working at the Produce Exchange out of all places. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's reported that he stole money from a Sunday school. So if you do that, come on, you've got no heart, right?
Yeah, this guy's shameless.
It's shameless. So he steals from a Sunday school and then he launders that money through a bank. Ferdinand Ward could care less about his victim, right?
So, you know, this guy sounds like a grifter, but he can't be too much of a grifter, right? Like he has to keep up appearances. He's not rubbing elbows or shoulders, I forget what you Americans say, with Ulysses S. Grant and all these important people if he's just this, you know, guy that just launders money, stealing money from Sunday school. So what was he like? Was he a polished guy or was he kind of a sneaky fella?
Believe it or not, Javier, Jeffrey Ward is Ferdinand Ward's great grandson. And Jeffrey Ward wrote a book about his great grandfather called A Disposition to be Rich. And he's a fantastic historian and author. He even worked with Ken Burns. And he describes his great-grandfather through his extensive research as being someone who was blessed with polish, charisma, the gift of the gab, right? He was buttoned up. He was so buttoned up that he courted an heiress named Ella Champion Green and married her in 1877. So he was, you know, sleazeball, just stealing from the Sunday school and just kind of pocketing the cash and running out the door. He was polished and sophisticated.
So from the outside, it seemed like he was a trustworthy person to invest with, right? He looked the part, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Yeah, he sure did.
So Neil, let's talk about how Ward met Ulysses S. Grant, because that was the hook for me. When you proposed this episode, I just had to look it up because, I mean, that's just amazing. And so it turns out that Ferdinand Ward's connection to Ulysses S. Grant is actually pretty simple because Grant and Ward was the name of Ferdinand Ward's investment firm. And the name Grant was actually Ulysses S. Grant's son. So this whole thing got started when Buck Grant, you know, Ulysses S. Grant's son, was going to Columbia University and his roommate's brother was Ferdinand Ward. And so Ferdinand Ward, he's this charismatic, successful financier, and he sees Buck Grant, you know, the son of the former president, and he tries to leverage that relationship. And that's when they formed this company, Grant Ward.
And it was with the blessing of the president, too, because Buck went back to his father and said, I've met somebody. And that person he met was an opportunist who saw the opportunity in having that relationship. So yeah, they hit it off. And then Ulysses S. Grant, what does he do? He says, ooh, that sounds like something that I want to be involved in. He is now retired.
Yeah, he's no longer the president.
He's no longer the president, but he's an American hero. And being able to use that name is pretty powerful. And Ward knew that.
Now, Ulysses S. Grant, he's a smart guy. He cut off the South from the Mississippi. I mean, the guy was an amazing war strategist, right? But he put his entire life savings, all his assets, under Grant and Ward. Yeah. And why would he do that, Neil? Like, why would this smart guy just put all his eggs in one basket?
Well, he met Ferdinand Ward, and he was so impressed with Ferdinand Ward and what Ferdinand Ward was selling that he was convinced. It wasn't just his son, Buck, you know, who went to his father and said, hey, can we just dump some money into this great investment opportunity? It was rather Ulysses S. Grant himself meeting Ward and saying, this guy has got it. This guy has it. You know, he is not running a Ponzi scheme, because at that point, it wasn't even a thing.
Oh, Charles Ponzi was in a crib.
Maybe he wasn't even born yet. I have to go check the date.
But it is around the same time that he's born, you know? But
yeah, so he has no thought of it in his mind. Well, I think it also goes back to the fact that the former president really believed and trusted his son.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a hard thing, because when your son has that conviction and then you validate it by meeting the individual, and you're also, you know, not necessarily wealthy, but you're financially stable and you have assets and you're able to invest those assets, let alone that he had so many collectibles, his clothing, his awards, memorabilia, swords, guns. These things are immensely valuable.
Yeah.
And today would go for millions and millions of dollars at auction altogether, right?
Yeah. But at the same time, he has all these memorabilia. But at the same time, Ulysses S. Grant has a lot of debt too.
He's not a great businessman. At least history has not painted him that way. And that's prior to his meeting Ferdinand Ward. He was a general. He didn't have experience in, you know,
financial,
the business
and
financial. Exactly. He was a strategist, a military strategist.
Yeah.
And a great leader. But here's, Javier, where I think we should go. We should really talk about the scheme itself, because it's fascinating and it helps explain why Grant, this, you know, revered figure, really believed in it.
So yeah, walk us through it. Like, tell me how this one fool a president.
I think the president wished he'd had warded off this one, because the Ward scheme was quite elaborate, and here's how it worked. Yeah. So Ferdinand Ward, he's charismatic, he's successful in appearance, and he's got a lot of connections, and he's got a lot of confidence. So one way to cozy up with the former president, Ulysses S. Grant, is to talk the language of government, and that's what Ward did. He said that he had access to government contracts, procurement contracts for commodities, and that he had ownership stakes in companies that could fulfill those contracts. So what he was basically selling was, invest in this. We can win these contracts. There's profits that come through the companies. There's also this, you know, this sort of loan servicing, this debt product for which you will get a return. So the upfront cost to cover the delivery of the goods to the government. These are very secure contracts. So Grant, who is a presidential figure, he's eating this up. And then once Ward gets Grant and Ward in the name of the company, he's then able to leverage that on everyone, because now it's validated. It's got to be legitimate. The president's involved, and the president is involved with something that also involves government contracts, you know. So now we'd think it's probably a conflict of interest.
It reminds me of that HBO show, you know, that zombie show, The Last of Us, where the fungus kind of infects the people. Oof. And Ward guy, he's that fungus. He latched onto the president, to the president's identity, and just created this financial scheme. And the president was just his host. You know,
it was just a host.
Yeah.
And he was completely infected with that fungus.
Yeah. Because it is kind of amazing where this story goes. You know, you would think that once the president realized that he was involved in a scheme like this, said he would go to war with Ward. But no, that didn't happen, did it?
No, it didn't.
Neil, what I find so fascinating about this story is that Ponzi schemes, even though this is a Ward scheme, this is before Charles Ponzi, the mechanics of it is basically the same, right? Like the same techniques that Ward used back then in the 1800s are still used today.
Identical. Right?
Like that hasn't changed.
But they're identical. You know, as I was digging into this, I was, well, I guess I wasn't shocked because the fundamentals of how you make a Ponzi scheme or a Ward scheme work, they require these things. You have to withhold factual information. You have to con, you have to manipulate, you have to lie, you have to deceive. But he also, you know, promised similar types of returns. He said, give me, you know, $50,000 and I'll give you 20% guaranteed annual interest on those loans. He falsified documents. He provided fictitious, you know, assets and liabilities on balance sheets. He created false contracts, government contracts that he was then sending and showing, oh, this is the contract that we're now going to be supplying these goods. And he, like Charles Ponzi, robbed Peter to pay Paul. So he just took the new investors' money and paid back the prior investors. And one of the reasons why this all fell apart was he was slow on making some of those payments. So people started to get a little concerned. But how did he spend all this money? Javier, you always add some sizzle when we get to the to how these Ponzi schemers spend their money.
Well, Neil, just like the actual scheme itself, some things never change, right?
No.
And it's how do you spend all that sweet dough? And of course, you know, Ward wasn't driving a Lambo back then, but he was splurging nonetheless, right? Ward diverted funds for personal use, just like any Ponzi schemer would. And they were financing their extravagant lifestyle. I'm talking about buying property in New York, like his brownstone in New York, or 25 acres in Connecticut. I mean, keeping up appearances isn't cheap. That money has to come from somewhere.
No, it is not cheap. And, you know, I wonder about that 25-acre estate in Connecticut. You know, if our listeners would like to go sleuthing and find out where that is, ping us. We'd love to know the address of where that property is so we can dig in a little bit more.
That would be cool. Road trip, Neil. Road trip.
We'll not do the research ourselves. I'm sure we could spend the time to figure it out, but we'd be super curious if one of you.
We're going
to
crowdsource this one.
Yeah. Yes, we're going to crowdsource it.
Well, Neil, of course, you know, like any classic Ponzi playbook episode, there has to be a collapse. And we're going to talk about that right after the break. So, Neil, tell me, how does a Civil War era Ponzi schemer get caught?
Ferdinand Ward, well, his Ponzi scheme came crashing down on May 4th, 1884, when he walked into a bank and successfully cashed a $10,000 false check. And that led to financial losses for that very bank. It was called Marine Bank. It was a friend of his, also possible co-conspirator, some have said. But that bank collapsing, and it started what was called the Panic of 1884. I hadn't even heard of this thing, but it collapses Ward's scheme. It collapses Marine National Bank. It then bankrupts Ulysses S. Grant and even some other people like Thomas Nast, right? Famous figure from history. And the most shocking piece of all of this, Javier, is that Grant and Ward was found to have just $67,174 of assets at the time that it fell apart, but it had $16,792,640 worth of debts, that is.
I can't even imagine. That sounds like a lot of money today.
It is.
I can't even imagine what that was back in 1884. I mean,
throw out a number. What do you think it was?
Do you know this? This
number? I do know it.
I'm going to try. Okay. All right.
This is really going to shock you.
Okay. So 16 million back then, I would say is close to a billion. I don't know. I'm just guessing. $1 billion. I did a Dr. Evil for those of you who are listening.
Well, it's not that much, but I am happy that you went very high because it is a large number. High.
Yeah.
It's a little more than 500 million bucks. It's a little more than 500.
So $500 million.
It's $500 million. Now, technically, if we really got down dollar for dollar using this, you know, inflation calculator, it's $527,407,000. So Ward's scheme was enormous, enormous.
So Neil, I think the most fascinating part of the story is that, you know, Ward's world is collapsing around him, right? He's freaking out, just like the end of any Ponzi scheme, right? You get this sense of desperation. And the desperation was that he needed money, right?
He did.
And who does he turn to? Who does he turn to for money?
He turns to Ulysses S. Grant, to Old Faithful, always the one who showed up with the money, who put his name on the door. It's amazing. He went right back to Ulysses S. Grant. Javier, he asked for a $150,000 loan from Grant. It's unbelievable. Wow. Right when it was all crashing down.
And Grant doesn't have the money, right?
No, he's at this point invested all of his money into Ward's scheme. He believes that these are legitimate investments. Yeah. He's cash poor, basically.
Yeah, but he is Ulysses S. Grant. And so he's well-connected. He has, like you said, lots of stuff.
Yeah.
So he turns to his buddy, William H. Vanderbilt. Okay. This is like the richest family in the world. Of course, how does he pay his debt to Vanderbilt? Well, like you said earlier, he has a lot of personal effects, a lot of historical items that, like uniforms, swords, and medals that today are probably priceless.
Absolutely. And, you know, Vanderbilt wrote him a check for $150,000, and Grant then gave that money to Ferdinand Ward because Ward came to him with his heart open, his hand out, saying, oh, we need this. And Grant is thinking, oh my gosh, I got to protect my own investments. I trust this person. He's got the wool pulled over his eyes. He then hands over that $150,000. It's lost. At that point, right? The scheme collapsed. It goes into the ether. And like you said, you know, he's an honest person. So he doesn't have a dollar to his name. He has this paper money. At least he thought on paper he was worth all this money through these investments. But he has all those valuable things in his house. He then gives those to William H. Vanderbilt. So William H. Vanderbilt, who wasn't pressing to get the loan paid. In fact, I've read that he was even willing to forgive it, but Ulysses S. Grant wanted to make whole on that obligation. So it's the complete opposite of Ferdinand Ward, the character. It's amazing. It's another testament to his great character, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But things don't end well for Ward. I mean,
eventually,
you could spin as many discs as you want, but it's going to come crashing down. And Ward was arrested, tried, and convicted of fraud, sentenced to 10 years, but he actually only served 6.5 years at the infamous Sing Sing prison. Ward even said in court that he had to, quote, rob Peter to pay Paul. So he knows.
Biblical guy.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, Ward, even Ward's wife, Ella, she rewrote her will. And she left all the money or all their assets to their son, Clarence, who was born just 2 months before the scheme collapsed.
So Clarence, interesting figure. He's not able, upon her death, to just get the money as, you know, an infant or a child. There are age restrictions around that. Clarence is a child. He's a minor. So he's not able to inherit the money free and clear. So Ward, who, as you just stated, spent 6.5 years in Sing Sing prison, well, what does he do upon his release? he tries to go back to the courts to untie her will. So he's trying to get access as her, you know, husband to those funds. So while that's all callous and seems like typical Ferdinand Ward behavior, right? Go to the courts, try to upturn it, get access to the money, take it from his son. The most remarkable thing is that Ferdinand Ward tried instead to kidnap Clarence. And this is what a New York Times article from September 14, 1894 reads. It's mind-blowing. It reads, "While the boy was playing on the lawn in front of his uncle's house at about 8 o'clock yesterday morning, a closed carriage containing two men appeared near the house. One of the men alighted, seized the boy, and dragged him screaming to the carriage. The men then drove off rapidly with the boy and were outside the limits of the town before an alarm could be given." It then goes on to say that Mr. Green, who was the boy's uncle, immediately telegraphed and telephoned to all the neighboring towns and cities, requesting the police to be on the lookout for the kidnappers. It continues, "In 2 hours, the closed carriage was caught at Webster, Mass., and the two men were arrested. Little Clarence was with them, unhurt, though badly frightened. He was taken back to his uncle's home. The men were held in Webster to await the action of the courts. And the boy will inherit about $80,000 from his mother's estate when he becomes of age." That's the New York Times article, word for word, Javier. It's remarkable. Yeah. And this was all orchestrated by Ferdinand Ward.
Well, his son was worth $80,000. So he was just another asset.
Just another asset. It was just another pawn in his chess match.
That's incredible. What a great dad. And you know what's pretty cool about this is that if you have like a newspapers.com or some sort of archival account, you could actually type in Ward's name and see a bunch of articles that he wrote in the New York Herald about Grant. And he admired him greatly. I mean, you could tell that he had a lot of respect for Grant. Yet at some point, he did admit that Grant was an easy target for swindlers.
That's amazing. That's a treasure trove. So
that Grant was a nice guy. Yeah, also an easy mark. So as you can imagine, this was devastating, I would imagine, to President Grant. I mean, he probably lost everything. And for nearly two decades, he was writing his memoir. Because think about it, if he could write his memoir, maybe he could make money for his family this way. So he teamed up with Mark Twain's publishing company, and they gave him a $25,000 advance on his autobiography. But, you know, time was running out for Grant. I mean, he was met with devastating news that he had throat cancer. I can't imagine that medical procedures back then were not what they are today. So if you had throat cancer,
yeah,
the clock was ticking.
Death sentence.
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of intensified the situation, and he had to complete his book as soon as possible. He completed his book, and he, at that point, secured his family's financial security. But sadly, just 3 days after the manuscript was complete, Grant passed away.
Amazing.
But today, Grant's memoir proves to be a colossal triumph. Shortly after his death, it sold more than 300,000 copies and generated $500,000 in royalties for his heirs. So back then, a lot of money. I'm sure that that autobiography and memoir has sold a lot more copies and has made a lot more money since then.
So if you read this history in a certain way, Ferdinand Ward gave us the gift of Ulysses S. Grant's memoirs because he was reluctant to write them. But because he was a pauper, because he had become bankrupt due to this Ward scheme, this Ponzi scheme, he then goes out and writes the memoirs. So it's a remarkable piece of history you just shared. And I hope our listeners will, you know, dig a little deeper into this. There's a lot of incredible history behind this story that we haven't even touched on.
I'm so glad you brought it to our attention because I'd never heard of this story. It's every now and then. I mean, I've been kind of impressed how timely our podcast is. We're always reporting on potential Ponzi schemes that are being investigated in real time. So to go back and look at one of the OG Ponzi schemers is kind of cool.
The OG, I like that. Yeah, this is definitely the OG. So
yeah. But I say, let's bring it back to modern times. What do you think? What do we got cooking? Do we have anything exciting? I always like how we do this. And by the way, listeners, this is for real, okay? Like a lot of our banter may sound like it's scripted, but this part is really real. When yes. I ask Neil what we're doing next time on the Ponzi Playbook, I don't even know what we're doing next time. And I don't even think Neil knows. And so we're looking at our list. We have a list of like dozens and dozens.
It's our Ponzi track and list. It's juicy.
Yeah, we're just kind of scrolling through and picking one and going with it. So what are we doing next time, Neil? The pressure's on.
Well, I'm bringing the goods. We're going to head down into a world of TikTok videos, into a world of Instagram posts, YouTube videos. This guy is the luxury watch Ponzi schemer. But I kind of like him. I don't know how to put it, but there's something about him. He's a complicated guy, and it's fascinating.
You posted about this guy, didn't you?
Yeah.
On Twitter?
I did. I said, yeah. It's about time they caught him.
And this guy, for those of you who don't know, I sat there and watched all his TikTok videos. This is a Ponzi schemer who was caught and took to TikTok confessing all of his crimes. And he's trying to figure out a way of repaying his victims. And he's chronicling this, and it is fascinating. So I'm really glad you picked that one, because that is going to be a pretty interesting episode.
That it is. And it's so fresh. He was just indicted by the DOJ like last week as of this recording. So this is juicy.
So we're going from the 1800s to like 2023, baby. Whiplash.
He's the great heir of the Ward scheme.
Oh, man. Well, I think you guys are in for a treat. So, Neil, we learned a lot of history today.
That we did.
What is a good piece of history that we could walk away with here?
Whatever you do, don't start a Ward scheme.